There is a young woman in this audience this morning from Seattle who is so delighted to be here that if everybody shared her joy, I think the room would explode. She worshiped with us when we were downtown, then she went away to New Zealand for a number of years, and then came back and found what we had done together. And she comes into this room with the most enthusiastic happiness of anyone I have ever known. Jane Mix Zimmerman, would you stand up and let us see you? We're happy to have you here. Thank you. Jane dated our younger son for some time, an experience that teaches one to endure the vicissitudes of life. She is now happily married with two lovely children of her own. It's interesting how different Christian worship is today from what it was like in the first century. We meet in expensive buildings designed for Sunday and empty most of the week. The early Christian church met in private homes, filled all week with family, and opened on Sunday for worship. We have musical instruments that cost more than some of them earned in a lifetime. They sang a cappella, choir directors unheard of, section leaders unimaginable. In fact, they sang with so much emotion at times that they had to be cautioned to cool it. We have a speaker we count on to stand up each Sunday. In their churches, different people stood up when the Spirit moved them, sometimes several of them at the same time. So when Paul cautioned the Corinthian church to do things decently and in order, it was because they were indecent and disorderly at times, not at all like a respectable worship hour on East 29th. But nothing was more different from our way than their way of celebrating the Lord's Supper. For one thing, we almost always have the supper in the morning, which makes the very name a little odd. At some time in my church life, I began to wonder why we called it the supper when we ate it right after we had finished breakfast. The early church at least remembered that it grew out of the Last Supper Jesus ate with his disciples at night. So when they celebrated it, they did it in the evening, and the word supper made sense. They also did it in the course of a common, ordinary meal, probably on any night of the week at first, and by on Sundays, because that came to be known as the Lord's Day. But in either case, there were people sitting around, eating what they had brought, and drinking the cheap wine that was a staple of their diet, and then at some point in the evening, pausing to reenact what Jesus had done that night in the upper room, letting the bread they had been eating all evening become holy for a moment, and the wine become sacred, with the room falling quiet as they thought of one who said before he died, "When you recreate what I did with the bread and wine that evening, do it as a memorial of me." What is surprising when we consider the Catholic Mass or the different Protestant frettings about communion, you know what they are. How often shall we do it? What kind of loaf and cup do we buy? How do we position the ushers? What is surprising is that those early Christian communion ceremonies must have been the most natural and easily understood rituals in the world. But being simple did not keep them from being corrupted by brand new Christians whose pagan past still dictated how they acted in church. So when you read Paul's letter to Corinth, his irritation is unmistakable, and much of it because of the way they were making a mockery of the Lord's Supper. You may be surprised by what Paul says in chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians, but an explanation goes something like this. In a well-to-do house in those days, the dining room held about 9 or 10 people, the atrium outside about 30 or 40. On the evening of a fellowship meal, a kind of potluck supper for the whole church, the few wealthy members in Corinth would arrive early, not having to punch a time clock, and take the best seats in the dining room with their host. They would have a couple of bottles of vintage wine and a carry-out dinner from the olive tree. Much better stuff than the late arriving poor would bring. So they started early to eat and drink rather than waiting to share what they had brought. By the time the tired dock workers and foundry men, janitors and road crews arrived to eat the meager stuff they had brought, a stale sandwich made at home that morning, or a Big Mac picked up on the way over, their fellow church members who hadn't waited were stuffed and potted. Paul says so, bluntly. Some of you are full, some of you are drunk. If time travel worked, can you imagine the consternation of a good Southern Baptist plunked suddenly down among these Greek Christians during a combination potluck dinner and celebration of the Eucharist? By late evening, more like a noisy bar than like church as we know it. But that didn't seem to bother the Apostle Paul nearly so much as something else. The whole point of the Lord's Supper was being missed. It was meant to unite the church as a caring fellowship, and here were people with no self-control destroying fellowship. I suppose the Lord's Supper might have gone on for centuries, being celebrated as part of a potluck dinner, if only people had known how to wait in love for one another. But they didn't, and so things changed. People brooded over the meaning of communion, analyzed it, spun subtle threads of theology from it, elevated it into what they called a sacrament, surrounded it with ever more dignity and ceremony, and the little ritual, once so simple, changed. Some men called priests came along, said to have special powers, who taught that when they spoke a blessing over it, the loaf of bread was miraculously turned into the literal flesh of Christ, and the wine into his literal blood. And then, of course, because the wine really had become the sacred blood, it couldn't simply be put back into the bottle if some were left over, or thrown down the sink. It had to be drunk, whatever was left of it, by the holy lips, and the cup had to be wiped so as to leave no trace of that blood. And the bread could not simply be dropped into the trash, but as the Lord's actual body, had to be eaten, every crumb of it, or there was blasphemy. And all the while, a solemn hush over the whole congregation. Everything about as far as possible from the noisy evenings at Corinth when the communion was part of dinner. And everyone was full of talk and laughter and the warming touch of the fermented fruit of the vine. Well, we changed all that. The church not only complicated what it was, in an infinite number of ways, confusing simple people along the way. We argued about transubstantiation versus consubstantiation, real flesh and blood, or only symbolic. We also argued about how often communion should be observed, and churches split over that. My church had a tradition that it had to be celebrated every Sunday of the year. Our Methodist friends did it once a quarter. Our Catholic friends on Sundays, but also on Friday night or Saturday night or Tuesday morning, whenever some special event called for it. And our Quaker friends declared that it was purely a spiritual meal and that no literal loaf or cup of wine need be present at all. But in my church, weekly communion was so essential that it became one of the greatest of all possible sins to miss it. True, the only thing Jesus had said about frequency was, as often as you do this, which clearly leaves it open for us to decide how often, but we made rules where he had made none, and we said, every week or else. And we made people feel terribly guilty if they missed. In fact, we made such a rigid law of a tender suggestion that if a person were on the road on Sunday morning and couldn't find a true church, and we knew what that was too, then we provided a second chance by offering it again at night. Isn't that strange? Two Lord's Suppers in one day, neither of them having a thing on earth to do with a meal, one of them rather artificially arranged to relieve a guilty conscience. I cannot believe Jesus of Nazareth had anything like that in mind. At our Sunday night meeting, after the sermon was over, some of you in this room will remember, the preacher would say, "Will those of you who wish to be served please stand up?" And then while we gazed at them, the folk who had missed the supper that morning got their souls in good order by taking it in a kind of lonely and scattered fashion that night. It bore about as much resemblance to the practice of the early church as an elephant to an ant, but custom is king. We were used to it, and we could not imagine a better way. We love to say that We were the only Christians on earth that worshiped exactly the way the early church did, when the truth was, of course, that we were profoundly ignorant of the early church, and that an actual recreation of the Lord's Supper, as it was managed in Corinth, would have scared us out of our socks. We might have gotten a little closer to first century communion if we had baked a rough loaf of bread and bought some cheap wine. But what we did instead was to order some commercially packaged Manischewitz cookies from a religious bookstore and some Welch's grape juice from the grocery. Well, we were free to make those choices, of course, just as in this place we are free to set aside this morning, or any morning we choose, a special time for remembering the love and the life of Christ. But I would like to say to you in all seriousness that our freedom is not absolute. We do have one obligation. Whenever we choose to create this memorial, and however we go about it, it must be an act of warm friendship and unity. Whether we sit here before lunch with no knife and fork anywhere in sight, or whether we sit at a potluck dinner with laughter and talk washing over us, is incidental and a matter of choice. But when we speak a prayer over a bit of common bread and a cup of some staple drink, we are requested to do it in a way that helps us feel the presence of His Spirit among us. So we have, in these next few moments, two simple things to remember. The life of one who exemplified love in the most extraordinary way, and the genuine concern for one another that brings us into this room as a family. Keep both of those in mind. And in Paul's words of long ago, we will eat and drink in a way worthy of Him in whose name the table before us calls us now to communion together.